Well, let me thank you, the organizers, for putting this conference together, in particular Jan Davison and Madison for helping us to be here and making all the arrangements. In 1905, Chinese groups across the Pacific started to boycott US-American goods. That was the year when the United States had excluded Chinese immigrants from taking up residence in the United States. In the course of the First World War, the transfer of German rights in Shandong to Japan added further to national humiliation and set off a second wave of boycotts in 1919 and in the 1920s. In December 1919, several thousand students forced their way into stores selling Japanese goods and either boycotted them or burned them straight out. A boycott bad goods society was duly formed, which a few years later also targeted British goods. Often wondered about the bad. Boycott good goods wouldn't sound so nice, would it? Now, boycotts have been implicated in key battles across modern history, from battles over slavery, land rights, we've just heard, national sovereignty and independence, questions of social justice and welfare, animal rights, and many, many others more. Now, we can see them in their own terms, and there will be plenty of opportunity in the next couple of days to do so. But it might also be helpful to try and think about developments across time to identify some shifting tensions and developments. And I've started with the Chinese case for a particular reason, not because I'm a Chinese historian, far from it, but it seems to me that the general literature in history, but even more so in the social sciences, so sociology and political science, has tended to start the story of boycotts from an Anglo-Saxon perspective, and particularly starting with either the battle over slavery or those over social justice in the 1890s and Edwardian period on both sides of the Atlantic. So it might be useful to just start with a story in which social justice isn't the key, and in which boycotts were also connected, in fact, to occasional bursts of violence. Now, my purpose here is I'm a bit of an intruder because I'm not an expert on boycotts, but I know a few things about consumption, and I've been working and finishing this history, which looks at shifts in consumption in different areas of the world from the Renaissance to the present, and here and there boycotts crop up. And this made me think about the history of boycotts in relation to politics and social movements in particular. Now, what I will do in my remarks is focus very selectively on three aspects which I think might be fruitful for collective discussion. The first one is the relationship of boycotts to the state. And I will try and give the state a bit more recognition than it sometimes has received. The second is a question about space. What are the spaces, moral and political spaces, involved in boycotts between the people who boycott and the imagined recipients of the effects of boycotts? And then the third, I want to say a few words about political subjectivity and practice. And given the subject matter of our meeting, I thought probably everyone will boycott something, so I will make a start and boycott PowerPoint. So you just have to do with these flowers. In the literature on boycotts in the social sciences, they tend to be shelved in libraries alongside new social movements. And the focus there is on movement narratives, recruitment, movement rituals, and so forth. What I want to do is shift that a little bit and actually start with the state and ask what role the state has. Now, one way to conceive of boycotts is as a substitute form of political action in contexts where there is no state power, where those agitating, those who find their way in the boycott, cannot rely on the monopoly of force that the state has. In the case of China, for instance, these people were acting in a vacuum of national sovereignty. Similarly, the great bursts of boycotts in the years, in the early decades of the 20th century, if you think of Swadeshi in India, China I mentioned, then the Waftist movement in Egypt in the 1920s and 30s, but also Galicia against Prussia, all these were scenes where the boycotters consciously were acting in a kind of political vacuum where boycotts took the place of arms, police, or other more formal forms of violence. The absence of the, or rather the missing sovereignty, is also one reason I would argue why boycotts in this period tend to evolve and be attracted to particular material forms of expression. Particularly clothing is very, very crucial in this case. Now, partly clothing is extremely visible and has a particular anthropological importance in the way we feel ourselves and we relate to others. But it is also a marker of what future national identity might be. So the boycotts of Western clothes, in the case of China, India, the Egyptian nationalists, is always connected to a more positive statement about what might be the clothes that true nationalists, true nationals would then wear. So there's a constructive side there that clothing assumes. The second, and now I'm moving up to a more demanding role for the state, second way to think about the state is to see the state as a target, an orientation for activists. And here, a good example, and we'll hear more about it later, is Richard Hussey's work on anti-slavery, who makes the, I think, very persuasive point that we must remember that British anti-slavery campaigners were not operating in some stateless, cosmopolitan, ethical space, but were presuming that their action is within that of the British Empire, and it ended where the British Empire ended. White label groups of the Consumer League in the United States, formed in 1891, and then similar groupings in Europe, all targeted either the law or the state, because ultimately they were seeing the consumer boycott as a bridge towards an institutionalized legal form of social reform. Many people have written about maternalism in this respect, and that's all right and good, but what seemed to have escaped them, that actually a lot of the women active in this case have real biographical links to the state. In the case of Germany, the Consumer League before the First World War was headed by Bethmann Hollweg's wife, the wife of the Chancellor. So these are not just people who are living in some subcultural space. Many of them have personal links to the state itself. Now, an even stronger claim I want to put forward is about a symbiotic relationship between the growing power and function of the state within society and the growing appeal of the boycott as an almost instinctive, natural way of trying to do politics at the grassroots. It probably is no coincidence that in the late 19th and early 20th century, when boycotts become more frequent, this is also the period when the state, as an actor, becomes more interventionist in laying down rules and regulations, warnings and communication about what citizens should consume. You can think of public health, you can think of campaigns for clean milk, whole nutritional science, which is supported by not the least armies. You can think of the First World War in state-led attempts to try and regulate consumer behavior, but what's wasteful, what's what not. What all these campaigns do is enclose goods and services with much more information and much more assumptions what their public role is, as well as their private taste and private satisfaction, than ever before. And I'm not, I don't want to, it's not a causal argument I'm trying to make. I'm not suggesting the state, through becoming active in public health and social reform, is causing boycotts. But there's clearly a symbiotic thing going on. And the amount of communication targeted at individuals as consumers, and the attempt to ask people to discipline and edit their behavior with a view to the social consequences of what they buy or how they eat, clearly enters a new period. And I think it's a mistake just to think of this as, well, this is the period when advertising becomes more important. The state plays a crucial role in this. These kinds of state interventions continue to matter these days, particularly in Asia. So the National Product Campaign, which in China has its roots in the 1920s, has received another fillip in the 1990s and 2000s, as the Chinese Party State is very keen to steer consumer-led movements and boycotts to favor Chinese goods. Korea, the Korean state, more or less pushed boycotts against American grapefruit in the 1980s, and current debates about island status and sovereignty. Again, many of these boycotts, the state has a hand in this. So that's the state. Second thing I want to talk a little bit about is this spatial dimension, and that's tied to something E.P. Thompson called the moral economy. What's quite interesting about that is that the term, the concept of moral economy, has had a second life in geography, or in the study of geography. Geographers have used it to argue that the recent burst of boycotts and boycotts signals a remoralization of the world economy, where consumers are once again stepping up to the plate and using their purchasing power to effect moral changes in the way the world is run. Now, at first glance, this looks like an interesting proposition. Denmark, which I don't think is represented at this conference. In Denmark, in 1990, 22% of all Danes boycotted at least once. In 2004, 50% of Danish people were involved in boycotts in one way or another. So that's pretty high. So you could say, well, yeah, it seems to be rising. Second thing which makes it look sort of appealing is that the recent well-documented upsurge of membership in grassroots boycotts and boycotts, fair trade and various other things from the sort of 1980s onwards in terms of numbers coincides with the new era of globalization. And if you remember where I started with China, so the years before the First World War, another era of globalization. The anti-slavery protests in the late 18th century, again, globalization. So perhaps there is something to that argument. There are some things one could say, but there's one major difference which I think has been overlooked and which I would stress and put in its place. If you look at the decade before the First World War, and take a sort of snapshot of where are the boycotts and what are the boycotts of in the developed world, Europe and Western Europe and the United States, most of them are concerned with local workers and shop assistants. It's a highly localized attention. Matchstick girls in Oxford, Parisian shop assistants who were made to stand for 15 hours a day and never get a day off. The awful bourgeois women who decide to do their Christmas shopping on Christmas Eve, giving shopkeepers in New York no time really to celebrate Christmas. So it's an extremely localized horizon, which is very different from most of the recent boycotts and boycotts from the 1980s, where the attention is almost the further away the better. The interest is in banana growers, coffee farmers, in West Africa, in Latin America, and so forth. There's far less attention now to the power of the purse to effect change, social change, in the immediate neighborhood. A tiny and partial exception is Sweden, where there are debates whether Swedish blueberries should really be marketed as Swedish blueberries if they're picked by Polish migrants who spend the summer in Sweden being paid 3 krona or whatever, 3 krona per hour. So there's a bit of that. But you know, if you just go down to South Bank, you have thousands of stands for fair trade. How often do you see South Bank occupied with people who ask you to keep your money in your purse to help those waiters or other clerical workers who are not getting by and are fighting about the living wage? So I think, you know, that doesn't mean there are, you know, the welfare state hasn't accomplished things, but clearly there are problems of poverty, living wage, social injustice remaining, but they receive far less attention from boycotters than they used to. Why is that? You can think of it as a shift in responsibility where consumers, once the welfare state came on, delegated responsibility to official institutions and hence looked beyond those institutions to groups which seem to have no spokespeople. And that's indeed true, particularly in the fair trade case, where fair trade is almost seen to fill a vacuum left by international organizations and commodity agreements. But there's also something slightly more sinister, I think, I would say, involved. Because, of course, if we go back all the way to the 18th century, there was that caring at a distance, which involved thinking about people in other continents and their living conditions. So what we can see is a kind of contraction, a spatial contraction of ethical responsibility, and then a renewed expansion. Why the contraction? At a time when people were tremendously concerned with social reform and went out of their way to boycott bad employers. Well, this is not by coincidence. The Edwardian years are not by coincidence also the time when imperialism goes into a higher gear. This is the time when exotic commodities become remarketed and revalued as national clean commodities. Cadbury starts selling chocolate suddenly as English chocolate. This is the time when Switzerland takes over the chocolate market and you see cows and Alps on chocolate packets and no longer tropical plantations. So there is something happening here where the distant others are somewhat written out of the script, or where assumptions about the material improvement of living conditions, which were still seen possible in the 1830s and 1840s by many reformers and missionaries, are now seen as with a sort of deep pessimistic dose. And so foreign distant consumers now only feature as coolies or plantation laborers. And importantly, in the big debate over Cadbury's maltreatment of plantation labor in Sao Tome and Principe in the Edwardian years, there was no consumer boycott. The only consumer boycott over exotic commodities in the pre-war years was in Germany, and that was because German consumers wanted cheaper coffee, not paying the poor devils a bit more. Um, Let me now turn to political subjectivity and practice. Now, the idea of the remoralization of the world economy is closely tied to the so-called idea of late modernity or post-modernity. The idea that we're in a new era where politics is now about life politics, to use Giddens's term, and people's identity and subjectivity are core sites for political action. Now, there have been two readings here. One is positive. This is all good. It expands the political terrain beyond political organizations and the state. The negative one is to say, well, actually, these boycotts are quite evil because they eat into and corrode and undermine established institutions. People think boycotts can accomplish things, but actually you need parties and the state. Now, both of these, the positive and negative, are, I think, doubtful and distorted for several reasons. I mean, one is that if you think about life politics, the 18th century struggles over slavery are all about bodily subjectivity. They're all about images of cannibalism, of drinking blood when sweetening one's cup of tea. Second point is the data belies the idea that boycotts and boycotts are competing with existing political allegiances and forms of action. The data accumulated by Michel Micheletti and colleagues, for instance, on Brussels and Montreal, large sample, show quite conclusively, I think, that the people who are more likely to join boycotts are also the people who are more likely to be a member of formal political parties or community groups, go voting, etc. So it's not really that the boycott is a new form of politics that sucks in previously neglected groups. Rather, it's yet another weaponry in the arsenal of already highly politicized groups. I want to end really by coming back to the state and by noting how much of the scholarly literature and debates have been obsessed with individual choice. Now, naturally, if you want to run a boycott, the appeal is to the consumer and for the consumer to remember his conscience and his responsibility. So naturally, there's an appeal to the individual. And people go on about it. Fair traders adverts about it's your choice. Again, these sort of ways of thinking about political action go a long way back. Edwardian boycotters compared the consumer to the clock, whose spring will regulate the economy. And again, there are similar images already in the late 18th century. But as historians, well, and indeed social scientists, we have to be careful that those are self-descriptions which are used for particular rhetorical and ideological purposes. They're not the same as what actually happens in the course of boycotts and their effects. And contrary to the idea that individual choice is accomplishing a lot in boycotts and boycotts, if you look at the reality, the whole boycott, I mean, take fair trade as an example, and the real advances there have been made with the help of either the state, at a local level especially, through municipal offices shifting their entire provision to fair trade, schools, mayoral halls, etc., or through firms doing the shifting for the consumer, so Cadbury and Nestle adjusting their entire cocoa supply to only sell certain articles in fair trade. That's far more important than what individuals may do through a boycott. So let me just conclude. In my reflections, I've parked a number of other dimensions which I know from the program will receive considerable attention, not least gender and race, and I'm sure these will be picked up. What I've tried to put back into the discussion is those of institutional context and relationships which tend to be left out in the literature on new social movements. That's important, I think, because often the literature on boycotts has tended towards the heroic. These are early vanguard social reformers who are fighting evil in the world. And of course, many of them were, but they were not just reacting to power. Boycotts, not least in their nationalist forms, were also complicit in power, shaping power and giving priority to some groups and some topics at the expense of others. On the eve of the First World War, Teresa Billington Gregg, a British socialist feminist and deeply involved in ethical consumer issues at the time, wrote, "We are all more or less profiteers. We are a shoddy people," implicated in low wages and abuses of social justice. Now, hundreds of years and many boycotts later, I think there's still some truth in that.